Welcome back to Computer Science E259. My name is David Malin. This is Lecture 4, XPath 1.0 and XSLT 1.0. Those of you who have been to London before may notice this map of London's underground. On the backside is yet a more complicated map of London's trams and trains, as well as the underground. And over the next 3 weeks, you will likely become all too familiar with the various routes that you can take in London's subway system and so forth. Similar in spirit, similar in design to the MBTA, but clearly you can get many more places and much farther out of the city than you can on Boston's own trains. This is my perhaps favorite project, at least until it comes time to introduce Project 3, that the reason being, it's very visual. And not only will you have a chance to dabble client-side with web page development as it relates to XML and XSLT-generated content, you'll actually have your own opportunity, ultimately, to generate a map not all too unlike this, using a language called SVG, Scalable Vector Graphics, which is an XML-based, scalable vector graphics-based language, and with which you won't generate quite this same picture, but you will generate the geographically accurate depiction of London's tubes, trains, and trams, because we give you, among other things in this project's distribution, geographic coordinates of all of the interconnections, all of the stops, all of the lines, and so forth for this complicated subway system. So it's a lot of fun, and the role of this two-sided color handout, which is also available on the web as PDFs, searchable no less, is to help guide you as you figure things out. You'll find that certainly savvy with the actual layout of the tube is not requisite for doing well in the project. I just think it's a little more fun and a less abstract when you can glance down at the map and see that, wow, where you put that stop on your own SVG does actually belong there. So we'll come back to that topic. But first, I wanted to motivate tonight's topic slightly by showing you a little bit of what goes on inside of the course's website. So you'll recall that the course's website has a number of main sections, like the lectures page, the resources page, the sections page, and so forth. Well, you'll notice, too, that there's a lot of shared structure to this site. And those of you who maintain websites know that updating HTML on a regular basis is not a particularly fun process, and it usually boils down to, for sites like this, a lot of copy-pasting, which in and of itself suggests some form of inefficiency. So what we actually did when putting together this site was we made it much more dynamically generated. In fact, what you're looking at now, let me adjust the lights slightly, is a file called lectures.xml. And this is, in effect, a configuration file, one of the configuration files that we use for the website. In concept, it's incredibly simple. All this is an XML file tagged appropriate to the kinds of data that we want to display on the web page. But the beauty of it, despite its simplicity, is that it's so incredibly easy for us to update the website and to post new handouts and so forth. For instance, consider where we are tonight. We are at Lecture 4, which effectively in this file is represented as this lecture element. So if you look up here on the screen, you see that lecture has an attribute called number, whose value is 4, available equals 1. Well, that means actually display this content on the screen. You see the date, the title, the subtitle, and then you see an enumeration of the kinds of handouts that are available. So available are, for instance, the lecture4.pdf file, which somewhat scrolls off the screen. We have examples, which you can see are available in 4 different formats, and so forth. This, of course, generates output like this. Notice that no resources are available for lectures 5, 6, or beyond. But if we wanted to get a little ahead of ourselves, we could scroll down to lecture 5. We could say, all right, you know what? Let's go ahead and release, let's say, next week's examples a little prematurely. I'll save the file, refresh the web page. What the back end of the website is now doing is relatively slowly spawning a JVM, applying Xalin, which is a software package we'll discuss tonight, to that lectures.xml file, generates some XHTML output, which we then cache for performance reasons, and now the website's been updated. Specifically, we now have lectures examples available for next week's lecture. So, you know, not a startling experiment by any means, refreshing that after changing things back to 0, we'll get rid of the content, but just a time saver in the end. And the only code I had to write initially was, well, I had to design the schema for this XML file. I had to decide for myself, all right, how are we going to represent a lecture? Well, a lecture element Seems pretty straightforward. Well, what's associated with a lecture? Well, maybe it's availability, yes or no, date, title. Well, what does it mean to be a handout? Well, it just might be an element called handout. Well, wait a minute. What if we make that handout available in a few different formats, HTML and PDF? How do we sort of write things in an extensible way that would allow us to plug in zero or more instances of the same handout and then have it sort of formatted precisely as we want? Well, the counterpart to this, then, is the actual generation. It's one thing just to lay out your data in one specific place, but what we also have driving the course's website are associated XSL files. So XSL, which will be one of our among our focus tonight, is extensible style sheets language transformations, XSLT specifically. And this too is written in XML, but it's written in a flavor of XML whereby certain elements have special meaning. They do certain things, and you can already see some of these constructs. Something like XSL variable is allowing me to define somehow or other the notion of a variable. We have this notion of a template, which is essentially similar in spirit to a function. Call template, as you might imagine, calls that template or calls that function. We seem to have the notion of parameters, and I'll just let us glimpse at this for now. But effectively, this file, lectures.xslt, is relatively simple. What it seems to be doing only is calling some template or function called display LSW, which is display lecture sections or workshops, which are another concept altogether, because most of the logic behind the website happens to be in a file called shared.xsl, because this content is shared among the various pages of the website. And you'll notice that there's, you know, a few different templates there, certainly maybe 100 lines or so of code, but those are XSLT templates. That is, those are examples collectively of XSLT, and that's precisely the language that we'll be introducing tonight. And in short, what XSLT allows you to do is transform XML into other XML, or transform XML into HTML, or transform XML into ASCII text, transform XML to SVG, the key being obviously this transformation. It is perhaps the language with which it is the language designed principally to transform XML. And you see it in all different aspects of the usage of XML, particularly when it comes to aesthetics and transformation of content. So with that teaser, let's recall for just a moment where we came from last time. So last week, we focused on DOM level 3, which was the second of two primary, particularly Java-oriented, for our purposes, programming APIs. The first, of course, was SACS. And hopefully what you got out of Project 1 was not only a bit of frustration in sort of figuring everything out for yourself, but really was a familiarity, not only with ultimately the actual SACS and or DOM APIs, but also just the underlying concepts, the notion of a start element event and the notion of a start document event in our simplified form, which was meant to sort of, you know, spare you some of the complexities of the actual APIs and really let you build up by question, I think it was 22, to where hopefully then the APIs, though somewhat more involved, numbers of parameters expected and so forth, hopefully at least there was more intuition and understanding as to how you might go about implementing something. But even with that said, you converted attributes with DOM. You could have done so with SACS as well. You could also do so in any number of ways. Fortunately, those ways that we'll begin to talk about tonight, XSLT primarily, would have been a yet easier approach. And what you'll see in a lecture or two's time is an XSLT-based approach that would have achieved that same task of converting attributes to child elements using, I think we whittle it down to maybe 3 lines of code. And that suggests the power, the flexibility, the usability of something like XSLT. So just as we began with perhaps the lowest level API, SACS, built on top of that DOM, recall that our DOMs were built out of SACS events, well, similarly is XSLT essentially standing on the shoulders of SACS and or DOM, being a higher level API yet, and thereby offering you yet more flexibility, more uses. We looked at JAXP and Xerxes. I did send out a clarification or a follow-up on this last night for those still sort of confused about the distinction, maybe just verbally tonight. What is JAXP? And don't just expand the acronym. What is JAXP? I can't put it on your resume so you can explain what it is. But you know JAXP. Otherwise, this would be a very awkward interview right now. Yeah.
Collection of
Okay, good. So it's a collection of Java classes and interfaces and so forth that allow you to interface with or interact with XML. It's a standard view of the XML world as it relates to a Java programming environment. Well, what does that mean? Well, in short, it provides you with classes, as you say, with which you can manipulate XML, with which you can generate SAX events, with which you can create a DOM, with which you can navigate a directory structure of a hierarchical structure of an XML document. So how does this relate then to Xerxes, which we also seem to be making mention of quite often? Xerxes is a parser. Apache Foundation, very good. Okay, so it's an XML parser made by the Apache Foundation that, among other things, implements the JAXP API. So an API doesn't necessarily have to be an implementation. Anyone can just make up an API. You could write down an API on a piece of paper or in, you know, a .h file in C or C++. Just because you write up the header file doesn't mean you've actually implemented the code. So Xerxes is an implementation of that actual API, and Sun, with their JDK, simply decided that the reference implementation of JAXP that they will ship in their JDK is what Apache put together. In the past, I believe they, Sun may have in the past, or rather Apple, I think, currently, with their implementation of JDK 1, Java 1.4.2, or J2SE version 1.4.2, uses an older parser called Crimson, which was also out of the Apache project ultimately, but it's been supplanted by Xerxes. But this too is why on macOS you want to override the built-in implementation as we've done with those jar files and the endorse directory and so forth. Xalen, meanwhile, is going to be Apache's implementation of another part of the JAXP API, the subset of it called TRAX, Transformation API for XML, and it too is just someone's implementation of an API. There are other implementations out there, Saxon being one that we highlight on the course of software page made by Michael Kay, who is the author of that big red book that if you haven't bought yet or looked at yet, you will, starting tonight, find it increasingly useful, but certainly not a necessity with so many resources online. And we looked at my first XML parser, on which I'll provide you with feedback within the next 2 weeks in time enough to process that feedback mentally before submitting Project 3. But take some comfort, if you're a little tired of Java or a little uncomfortable still with Java, that Project 2 is entirely client-side based with XSLT and other such things. There is no, we're taking a three-week respite from Java programming. But that's not to say that Java does not remain a prerequisite for the course. Comfort with Java is what we say. So if you are not quite comfortable, do bear that in mind, that it will come back in a few weeks' time. All right, so this was an example document. DOM is what? This is not DOM. You're eager to say something. Perfect. It is a representation of XML in terms of nodes and trees. Nodes in a tree. So we drew this picture last time, and in fact, there was a bug in this DOM that one student caught when looking at it. And I'll point out the bug, and how about we'll leave it as a verbal exercise here to explain why it's a bug. But you'll see in that top right text box, I stated in lecture last week that the value of that textbook, the text node, was \n\t. The \t should not have been there and was removed from the online PDF, sort of 1984 style in this course. Why is that incorrect? Explain why that was a typo. Comes after the end of the student tag. Exactly. So notice that because this text node is a child of what node? It's a child of students, and it's a sibling of the student element, but it follows the student element. That is, it's to the right, which means effectively that text node appears after the end tag for the student element, which puts us, I can't quite reach, but right up there. There is indeed a new line character that brings us to this final end tag, students, on the last line, but there's no tab character. So that was simply my oversight, but it certainly doesn't belong in that box. So I left it in here tonight because it's sort of a useful discussion, but beware of the distinction, especially if you were practicing with this particular fragment with your own code and for some reason you weren't getting that particular character's events. Incidentally, something worth noting, again, SACS. How many character's events will be fired, for instance, by this sequence of characters? We will have, of course, just to back up, a start element callback function, callback method incurred. Right? It will be start element with a name of student and null attributes, because there are no attributes. Then you're going to get logically a character's event. What's the character's event going to have as its argument? Sorry? Okay, so it's going to have it's like an array of characters, of chars, and then it tells you the start and the end or the length. But what specific characters are going to be in that array? What's the value of this character's event going to be? If you will.
Undefined.
Undefined? Why do you say that?
Well, it could come in little chunks or it could come all together.
So maybe not so much undefined as it is uncertain. It depends, is our age-old answer. So why is that? Well, let me put it another way. How many characters events will be called for the processing of this text node? Could be one, because it could be a characters event where the argument is, quote-unquote, Jim space Bob. Could be what else, though? Could be 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then the space in the middle, 7. SACS does not guarantee that contiguous chunks of characters will, in fact, be globbed up together and packaged up in the same characters event. However, DOM does make a guarantee. What you see here is the correct DOM. DOM, the API, does guarantee that when you construct a DOM for some XML document, the characters will be normalized such that you will have one and only one text node, where appropriate, containing as many contiguous characters as is possible. So though it's a nuisance at the SACS level, if you're programming at that level, once you have a DOM in place, you can trust that the only text child of name is going to be this single text node. There would not be multiple text nodes as siblings of one another. Now, how many of you, thinking back, when you implemented your own DOM builder, you didn't have to do this. But how many of you, if your DOM builder was passed multiple characters events in a row, would have normalized the values of those events together and created just one text node? Or would your code instead have created a J node, an I node, an M node, a space node? Probably the latter, and that's fine, because we didn't specify as much or require as much at first, but just consider now that you've done that, sort of what of a nuisance or what an additional step that would have been to actually normalize these nodes together into just one. You would have had to maintain yet more state so as to clump everything together if you have multiple characters events. Fortunately, now that we get to start playing again at the JAXP level, you can trust that the DOM will actually contain just single nodes. If, however, you make changes to a DOM, as we'll see, as we saw a demonstration of last time with slash prices and so forth. Well, if you make changes to a DOM that effectively insert new text nodes into the document, well, then you could break this normalization. But if you look closely at the DOM API, the JAXP API, there is a normalized method that quite simply looks for all text nodes that are siblings and crunches them up into a single text node. But it would be up to you, the programmer, to call that if and only if you've actually made changes to the DOM. These, of course, were just some of the packages and or classes or interfaces that were relevant to DOM in particular with JAXP and Xerxes. My first XML parser, of course, was relegated to its own package, which we focused on last week and with Project 1. And that brings us then to tonight's topics and the transformation at a higher level of XSL. Are there any questions on Project 1, DOM, SACS, XML, or where we're going? Cookies? Cookie requests? No? I can stand over here and avert the camera away from the cookies. That is the disadvantage, of course. That is the only disadvantage, of course, of taking this course via distance education. There are no cookies, sadly. So, CSS. How many of you have used it before? Okay, so even me. Two of me. So, yes, you've probably used CSS before. What have you used it for?
Formatting a page.
Yeah, so formatting a page, doing more intricate formatting details to HTML or XHTML that you can't really do with just the font tag alone or the blink tag alone and so forth. It allows you to exercise much more fine-grained control over the aesthetics of your web page, even leveraging some client-specific features like a specific font that might be installed or other such details that you can or can't do necessarily with HTML, or at least as refinedly. Well, CSS is then cascading style sheets, and in effect is a language with which you can transform things. It's a language with which you can transform or affect the behavior or the display of an element, an HTML element or an XHTML element. Well, so was it considered early on as a possible transformative language for XML. Right, if you've got an XML file, not unlike our lectures.xml, and you want to display it, well, you don't want to just show people the raw XML file. It wouldn't be a very useful course website if we just gave you a page and said, here's the XML, you go highlight what you need to get and then paste it. I mean, it doesn't really work well. We'd probably want to format that for you in hypertext markup language, HTML. Well, how could we do this? Well, you could make use of something like CSS. In fact, among our examples tonight in lecture 4 contents, copy them over here. We have a few different files, one of which is myblockbuster.css. It's a very simple file, two lines of actual content. Describe or translate into English, if you would, what this kind of CSS would be doing. Ignoring for the fact that in HTML, so far as I know, there's no movie element or movie tag. Yeah?
So it takes all the movie elements and displays them as blocks.
Okay. Okay. So say it's a margin of 20 pixels beneath each such block. Okay, and you were saying? Right, so for title elements, again, it's not an HTML construct, but if you infer from this the sort of significance that this markup would have in the HTML world, well, what that second line is doing is altering the display or the behavior of the title tag, as you say. It seems to be making any title tags content be in a font size of 20 point and a font family of Arial and a color of, who knows their hex codes?
Green.
Green, 00FF00. We'll come back, perhaps, for E259 trivia as to why that's the case, if you don't know. Okay, so pretty straightforward, if boring. Well, what might we do with this? Well, in myblockbuster.xml, which is a file which you'll similarly be quite acquainted with over the next 3 weeks, you have a small database of actors and movies. Movies that you might be able to rent from a place like blockbuster.com, so associated with movies. And as you might imagine, and this appears in your printouts tonight, I'm associated with a movie, for instance, like this movie called, let's pick one that more of you have probably seen, The Fugitive. So associated with The Fugitive is some kind of unique ID, which is ID 1235AA0, the title, Fugitive, comma, the, an image name, fugitive.jpg, a genre, a rating, a summary, details, a year, some other stuff, and then something of slightly more interest, an actor ref, whose value is some number. It turns out, if we read carefully, that you would actually see those numbers up here as well. So, for instance, just to put this into perspective, we have actors 0003 and 0006. Well, who are those? Well, let's see where else in the file this appears. Looks like Tommy Lee Jones was in this movie, because we have actor elements higher up in the file whose IDs happen to match the ID actor references later in the file. And then we had that other guy who was 006. Who's that going to be? Harrison Ford, who I had to keep toggling because apparently he's been in several other movies as well. So, yeah, it looks like this must be our Star Wars film as well. So, in short, it's a database of movies. Could have laid it out in any number of ways. We chose to lay it out in this way. And even if you just eyeball the thing, you don't need a README file explaining how this works. It's pretty self-evident. But that's not to say that you would want to just post this content up on the course's webpage or on blockbuster.com's webpage and let people figure out how to navigate that content or how to interpret that content. Rather, you'd probably like to transform that into something a little more familiar, something a little more user-friendly. Well, in tonight's examples, we have that file again, but we also have this file locally on my machine, since we're about to make use of some client-side processing. Notice that the very top line of this file, it's a little small for the moment, but we have that first line, which, though small for now, is called what? Actually, let's do it in, let's open this in IE instead. Or, no, we'll open it in this program. Bigger font now. Very first line is generally called XML declaration, tells us the version of XML, the encoding, boring details. After that, we've got some white space, which you now know all too well is allowable. We now have a comment up here as well. That too is allowed. That's for the human. Then we have this thing, which generally is known as the root element. If I just try to view this file now in something like Internet Explorer, as I rather unreasonably proposed for a user, well, Internet Explorer does its best to show you the contents of this file, but it's still just XML markup. As an aside, the means by which IE and other browsers tend to display XML content, notice, after all, that it's nicely syntax highlighted now and color-coded, and in IE at least, you can even interact with it by clicking on these little pluses and minuses. Well, it turns out behind the scenes, it's XSLT that is displaying the content to you in this way. It just so happens that their XSLT style sheet, again, more detail later, simply makes it still look like XML and allows it to be a little more interactive with how they've marked it up. But we want to do something slightly more interesting. So what I propose here on our slides from tonight is this construct. Make it a little bigger. What is this kind of thing generally called? Yeah, it's a processing instruction. And up until now, we really haven't used these in any way. But we did say that generally that a PI is meant to be a processing instruction that is an application directive. It has a name, which is the sequence of characters that immediately follows the bracket question mark. And then it just has a value, which we've said, even though it might look like attribute value pairs, it's really just one long string. And for human purposes, it's useful to display it like that, sort of intuitive, but the program would actually have to parse that itself, for better or for worse. So what I'm going to do is go into our XML file, and I'm going to paste this at the top level of the document, just beneath the XML declaration. Just going to make that one simple change. Notice that the PI's name is XML-stylesheet. Its value is this long string, but clearly there's some sort of referencing going on to myblockbuster.css, that file we looked at. So let's see now what IE does with this when I again refresh it. Well, quite the dramatic change. And I didn't promise anything pretty, but quite the dramatic change. What is striking to you as it relates to our conversation a moment ago? What's just happened? So we have blocks of text, think paragraph tags in HTML, or div tags in HTML. There's that 00FF00. The titles of these movies, though slightly unreadable on the screen, are in fact in green. Everything else, though, sort of a mess. It's just been passed through literally. And that's because, recall that in our style sheet, we didn't really tell the browser, the application, what to do with any of the other elements. And so typically the default behavior then for an element whose behavior hasn't been specified or overridden, is in XSLT to just spit it out, literally. And so what you get is some really nasty content, but all of the content for the file, except for instance, what we've manually overridden the behavior of. In fact, if we want it to be a little more playful, let's pick arbitrarily another element to modify. I'm just going to open my little text editor here. Text is going to be a little small. Recall that this is the file for movies. Pick an arbitrary field that you'd like us to mark up slightly more interestingly. Okay, the rating. So I'm going to go back to my style sheet. I'm going to say rating. What do you want to do to it? Sorry? Different color right here? All right, so we're going to say color equals FFOOOO, which is going to be red. Anything else? Well, let's just make font size equals 72 points so that the rating really jumps out at us. I'm going to save this file. I'm going to go back to IE, refresh. It's quite clear now what the ratings are. So clearly, CSS, even in the domain of XML, lets us exercise much more control over the display than just spitting the contents out raw. But really, all you get with CSS is aesthetic modification. There's really no construct that I know of, and probably that you know of, with which you can apply logic via the style sheet, right? You can't sort of loop over all of the title elements. You can't logically filter out all of the title elements except those whose rating is, all of the movie elements except those whose ratings are G. For instance, if we wanted to create a filter that only showed us kids' movies, well, CSS, can you even imagine a way of taking that XML content and displaying only the movies whose ratings are G? So, okay, so go on. What could you do with it?
Well, we developed applications for customers where, based on data coming into the page, if it was out of spec, you know, we had a lookup table that told us our parameters.
Okay.
So if it was in a warning state, it would change the color. If it went into alarm state, it would change the different colors. We had conditional format.
Good. And what with what syntax were you implementing these conditionals? Okay, good, good. So what, where did you find limits to be, or did you? Were there things you felt you couldn't do?
No, the limitation we did find is it's kind of interpreted so that depending on the speed of the machine or certain things, sometimes it would update and sometimes it wouldn't. So
okay. Okay. So it sounds like it wasn't bug-free then. No? Okay. Okay, so fair enough. Though that's perhaps not a condemnation of the language itself. What you'll see here, though, is that with relative ease, can we now, with something like XSLT, start to actually program against the content? Can we actually manipulate the content? Can we actually pass content around literally with a functional programming language rather than with something that's, say, more of a markup language or a tweaking mechanism. So to see that, consider this. XPath. XPath is a query language, a relatively limited query language, but it allows us, within the confines, as we'll see, of an XSLT document, which we'll come back to shortly once we have a few programmatic concepts, allows us to query aspects of data. That is to say, if you have an XML document and you want to pull out of that document only the ratings or only the titles, well, XPath expressions allow you to, with a very path-like syntax, you know, like a C colon backslash-like syntax, pull that kind of information out of the document and even, along the way, filter content out that you don't want through predicates of sorts. XPath itself is a language, XML path language. It's been around since pretty much the advent of XML and XSLT. Version 2.0 has sort of been in a holding pattern for a bit of time, but will, along with XSLT 2.0, hopefully redress some of the shortcomings that you yourselves will likely trip over the next few weeks as you realize that the first versions of these languages, while fairly well designed and implemented, have limitations, which are maybe not so much design limitations because they were intentionally left out, but as the adoption of these languages has become more common, more and more programmers start to feel or feel frustrated by what you can't do with the language as opposed to being impressed by what you can do with the language. Yeah. So it's a good question. There absolutely is some overlap between what you can do with XSLT and CSS for now, and we'll come back to this issue, I think the answer that we often give is that I think, certainly, that XSLT is good for a lot of the processing of the document, whereas CSS, I think, is good to take things the final leg home. Where XSLT, you transform the content into pretty much the format that you want, but use CSS, as you already do in the HTML world, to really fine-tune the finishing touches, if you will, on the aesthetics of the content, whereas XSLT, I would say, is much better at actually pre-processing and generating the content itself. But I think we'll come back to that too as we look at some of the features or lack thereof of XSLT. Another question? Good question. So in the context here, it's the browser that supports the CSS level 2 specification. And so upon reading the .css file, it is the processor built into IE that applies that style sheet to the XML document.
So if I'm using a different client, I might get a different behavior, I might get different capabilities.
Theoretically, and this is sort of the issue with browsers or just software in general not supporting specs consistently and only the specs themselves. With CSS, you probably have more uniform support over the display of information than you did with just, say, HTML back in the day. But still, too, it is processor specific, and we'll see that even with XSLT, as I've alluded to, with Stylus Studio, XML Spy, Xalen. They think they're doing you a useful thing by supporting other features that aren't in the recommendation, but oftentimes that breaks code if you then try to port it over to another implementation. So, incidentally, before we included this CSS tag, sort of begs the question, who was creating this output? Well, this, of course, is Internet Explorer, but it turns out that built into Internet Explorer, or really Windows these days, is not only an XML parser called MSXML, but also an XSLT processor. And we actually have a link to that on the course's website to the very latest Microsoft XML parser and XSLT processor, and it's what IE, for instance, uses to actually display this content to you. And other applications, including Stylus Studio, you can tell it to use MSXML as your parser as opposed to something like Xerxes or a JVM running Xerxes. Well, let's take a look at this query language because you... Oh, let's not take a look. John?
We can go back just to that page.
To which page? This? It is, but it has been processed by Internet Explorer.
In what sense?
In the sense that it's been syntax highlighted now, in the sense that, and this is sort of beyond the scope of XSLT, really, in the sense that you can now expand and contract things. If it were just displaying the XML file, it would look more like, and this is TextPad, it would look like this. That is the XML file. IE is clearly doing some rendering of it because you get, among other things, this pretty printing and the syntax highlighting and this interactivity. So it's not just displaying it. It's spicing it up, certainly. Even though, on the whole, it just looks the same. But there's some processing going on.
Okay, so the parser that looks at that, it just decides to display it like that. And as soon as you put in the CSS path at the top of the declaration, and then so then it takes that into, the parser takes that into consideration and...
Exactly. So MSXML, the parser and the processor that Internet Explorer is using, by default, like in the Windows world, will look at the file extension and see, oh, this is a .xml file. Moreover, hey, here's the XML declaration, definitely an XML file. It's just going to render it as XML with the default XSLT template, which if you actually search your hard drive, you can find it, and you can change the built-in display of XML documents that IE does. This PI, once pasted into the top of that XML, is a directive, essentially, to MSXML, or IE, saying, don't apply your default behavior, process according to this instruction. Yeah?
If you've got, for some reason, have another PI document,
okay,
and it, for some reason, overwrites or says something different for the database tag.
Okay. So if you have multiple PIs specifying multiple style sheets, that is a good question, and I'm not sure because I've not tried it in MSXML. I'm going to hypothesize that in the spirit of CSS, it would be cascading, in which case the secondary and tertiary inclusions of CSS files might override any existing specification, but I'm not sure, to be honest. Easy enough to play with, though, by testing it out. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we're going to glance for a second back at this slide that I'm so determined to show, just to state that this is what's called a location path. There's clearly some path going on, but before we actually tease apart some of the jargon and the concepts, let's actually play around with the XML file. So this program that I launched earlier is a program I've mentioned the name of a few times. It's Stylus Studio. You can download this via the course's website. We've arranged with the company to get you a semester-long, if not slightly longer, fully licensed trial period for several months. You just have to follow the instructions on the course's website. I tend to use this one on a PC for just editing XML. You do not need any special software for this course, certainly, that's not freely available, or certainly you need no special software to write XML, right? A wonderfully free XML editor is available on your own hard drive, right? Or in terminal, you can use VI or Emacs or the like on a Mac OS. However, the beauty of a program like Stylus, even though I am using perhaps 1% of its functionality, is syntax highlighting and little drop-down menus that will, like a typical IDE, simplify and expedite the process of developing XML. A more popular alternative to Stylus Studio, also available on the course's website, also with a E259 specific license for the semester, is, yes, XML Spy, made by a company called Altova. They have very similar, if not almost identical, functionality. With that said, here is my blockbuster.xml as seen through the eyes of this program, which for our purposes is little more than a pretty text editor tonight. Suppose, though, that I want to query data from this document. Well, suppose that I want to get out all of the titles of the movie in this document. Well, how do you do that? Up until now, when we have processed XML files, we've only done so in one of two ways. In other words, if you wanted to write a program that printed out the titles of all of the movies in this database, how could you do it, knowing what you know tonight, or prior to tonight? What would you do?
Using
Okay. A parser, sorry?
Using programming.
So programming, specifically?
Yeah. We can use the parser.
So you could copy our own Sax demo, and you could slightly tweak the start element routine to only print out the values of the elements called title. That would be one way. DOM, our DOM builder demo, or our document builder demo, you could simply build a DOM from the document and then navigate through the tree following the child pointers, looking for elements called title, then dive down one level deeper and grab the value of their text child, print things out. Also kind of clunky, but you could do it. Or you could cheat altogether and write a little one or two line Perl script that just grips through the file with a regular expression. That would work, but not quite in the spirit of scalability when we want to start doing more interesting things. Or, starting tonight, you could whip up a little XSLT style sheet, particularly if your goal is to just output a bulleted list of these movies, a new XML file altogether, or better yet, an HTML web page, which will make the demonstration a little more interesting. Well, how do you programmatically select nodes from an XML document? And I'm going to use the word nodes in this context, even though it's a flat file, in the same spirit of DOM. You can imagine what the nodes are in this document were you to parse it as a DOM. Well, suppose I want all of the title elements. Well, what is the hierarchy that would lead me to a title element? If this denotes, as in most systems, the root of something, let's say the root of our document, what's the path to a title element? Okay, not quite. Database is our root element. And then, okay, so we want actors? We can just skip that and we'll say, right, just as in a Windows file system, you can have two folders, one called actors, one called movies. We only include the one we want in our path. So movies. Oh. No. Movie. There we go. Good. Don't forget the hierarchy. And again, you have a printout of the code since I haven't scrolled down far enough in this particular setup. Now? All right, good. Well, what is this going to return to us? Well, one of the nice things about Stylus, too, as with XML Spy, is that even beyond editing, they're really useful learning tools just for tinkering around and evaluating expressions and even testing what code you might want to write. Well, let's try this. Slash, I'm in this little text field at the top of the screen, which I cannot, unfortunately, make bigger for us. /movies/movies/title, enter. And what you get back in Stylus on the right-hand side are a bunch of hits. So think of this as a sort of search or a query that we executed. Well, generally speaking, this is what XPath is all about. XPath allows you to write queries that return what are called node sets. And as the word suggests, it's a set of nodes from the document matching the path that you specified. So we'll see in a moment when we actually put XSPath in context into a program, like a Java program, or for tonight, into an XSLT style sheet, what it allows us to do is open an XML document, grab a bunch of nodes, and then essentially put them in some kind of linked list or what have you that we can then start processing on the client.
So if you did grouping instead of title, you go back to that
one? Sure. What you'll get is exactly this. And notice now, one of the reasons for reinforcing last week that notion between the name and a value of a node. On the right-hand side, what do we have? We have the name. We have the nodes themselves, which happen to be nodes of type element. But there's no value of each of these nodes because they themselves are elements, right? It was a null value for the element. But if we expand it visually, and this too is why stylus or XML spy is useful, you can tinker and look inside like a debugger. Well, what's inside a movie? Well, hierarchically, there's an attribute, which stylus uses this weird little icon to represent. There's some kind of text node. Oh, that is our backslash n, and in this case, space, 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 or tab characters, effectively. Then we have a title element, which here has, and they're cheating here a little bit, because title is an element, which means it doesn't have a value proper. But generally speaking, we did say that the value of an element is, in effect, the concatenation of all of its descendants. So what's the descendant of this title? It just happens to be startup.com. So here, too, you know, stylus visually, and visually it's OK. It takes some liberties in what it calls the value. But it would have been more proper to have this expand one level further to show you the text node underneath. But not a big deal. More useful, arguably, this way. So that was a good suggestion. What if I do this and go one step further? What am I going to get back?
Movies,
so a node set of size 1. And that's precisely what I do get back. What if now we want to be a little more clever, and I want to get back all of the titles, but only those titles of movies rated R? I don't want to rent some, you know, Pinocchio. I want to rent some, you know, adult movie tonight. So I want the R-rated movies. So how could we query this? Well, how would you do it in Sachs? Again, you have to write a start event, a start elements handler that not only now looks at the element's name, you now have to iterate over the attributes list that's passed in, and then only do something if you find the attribute and the value that you're looking for. DOM's a little easier. You can still recurse through your document looking for nodes called movie, then check the rating child of that. And I said attribute before. I didn't mean that here because everything is a child. We want to look for the rating child, then check its value or the value of its text node, and then we can do something. That kind of, too, is a pain. XPath and XSLT, it's pretty easy. Those of you who committed to memory our location path syntax before, what would you propose? We want to do rating equals R somewhere. And the syntax in XPath is you write a predicate at the point in your location path where it's appropriate to do the filtration. So rating is not associated with titles. So it would be sort of weird to say something like where rating is R, because titles don't have ratings. What do have ratings? Movie. So conceptually, we go back here to movie, and the syntax we use is a square bracket, and we're going to say rating equals, quote unquote, R, enter, and now I get back just those titles that belong to movies rated R. So pretty neat, pretty simple, and the beauty of XPath, frankly, is it's so conceptually consistent with what you might want to say when you want that piece of data out of the document. It's a hierarchical document. Why not write the query as a hierarchy? And so that brings us then back to this canonical form. This is an excerpt of a location path. And I say excerpt because it doesn't begin with myblockbuster.com's root element, which we did, in fact, with our demo do. But it fits nicely on the slide to just consider this part. So this whole thing is called a location path. Right? It tells you the path to some location in the document. Well, in this case, it's telling you to start with a node or nodes called movies. And we're going to ignore the stuff before the colons for now. And each of those things is called a step. So this is a step. This is a step. This is a step. It makes intuitive sense, right? You're stepping deeper and deeper into the document. Well, you have a node test that follows, or that is part of a step, and you have what's called an axis that's part of a step. Now, we didn't use any axes here. In fact, they were implicit. In this case, we're being ever so more explicit. We are saying, yeah, start at the root of the document, this document. Then choose all children that are called movies. So when axis specifies in effect what kind of step do you want to take, and the node test clarifies what the name generally of that step, of that element or node should actually be. So on this left-hand side, we had a step. The axis is, of course, child. The node test is movies, which means upon stepping into the document, following the current node's children, only choose those children whose name passes that node test. In this case, there was just one movies element. From there, you at this point in our story, when you start with that slash, child, :, movies, slash, at that second slash, conceptually, you have a current working set of nodes. In the context of our demo code, or myblockbuster.xml, that node set is of size 1. What the location path proceeds to do with additional steps, then, is to refine that node set, either augmenting it or shrinking it, taking nodes out or putting nodes in, depending on whether or not you have predicates and so forth. The next step we happen to take here is to say, okay, now, considering all of the nodes that the first step returned, which was 1, a movies element, follow the child axis, which means consider in turn all of the children of the node or nodes generally in that node set, and then only return or retain those nodes that are children of the nodes in your current node set that are called movie, singular. But there we have a predicate. Predicates can take the current node set and filter nodes out, in effect, or keep nodes in, depending on your perspective. What that is saying, and it's slightly different from our own MyBlockbuster example, is choose only those movie elements whose rating equals quote-unquote R. But in this context, and I made it slightly different so we could introduce one more piece of syntax, notice the special symbol, the at symbol. Now, just phonetically, take a guess what the at symbol denotes. Not substitution. I'm looking for an attribute. So that's why they chose this as a special symbol. The at symbol is, in effect, shorthand for an axis that's not child, but that's attribute. So when you have an axis of attribute, what you're saying is consider all of the nodes in your current node set, but next, in turn, only consider the attributes of those nodes, as opposed to the children of those nodes. No, and that's why I'm making the distinction. In our slide here, I wanted to involve some more syntax with the at symbol. In the context of myblockbuster.xml itself, notice we did not have at rating. And in fact, if we do say at rating, our node set goes to 0. Well, no movie elements have an attribute called rating, so it doesn't work. But what if I did this? What if I... We could go to movie, because movie elements have IDs. So movies, though, don't have any attributes. But a movie has an attribute. So I could, just to demonstrate here, say, all right, well, what about an attribute called ID, and let's only pick the movie whose attribute happens to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Enter. I get back one movie, because only one movie element has that attribute and the corresponding value, and we've retrieved its title. You can do a wild card. What kind of wild card would you want to do? This is, so you can do wild cards with some limitations. It's not nearly as powerful as regular expressions. You couldn't specify a pretty arbitrary pattern. The best you could really do in a simple form with the built-in syntax is a starts with, or ends with an effect. So you could say, give me only those movies that, let's see if I get the syntax right, starts with, I'm going to say dot, and then S. Did I get it wrong? Oh, wait. There we go. So what I just did was I used another built-in XPath function, or actually our first XPath function, because notice the parentheses I used. What I'm choosing now is the root element. Choose its database child. Choose its movies child. Choose its movie children, but only retain those whose title, children, starts with the letter S. And you can do some more tricks, but fairly limited, I would say. Not as powerful as a wildcard as you might hope. And notice, incidentally, that I would be equally correct so that we're now consistent with our verbose syntax. Really, to be clear, I could have said this. I could have said child here. And over here, I similarly could have said child. And then over here, child. Notice, no change. It's more fun. It's easier to type it the first way. It's more proper. It's more verbose to write it this way. But in this example, too, the at symbol is itself short for attribute colon colon. There's a lot of shorthand notation, and we'll come back to that in a second. How do you search for two different, how do you apply two different predicates? You could say this. So I know it's small, it's tough to see, but what we just did was, all right, let's make this scroll over a little bit. So what I now said with this small predicate, why don't I blow it up for the sake of discussion? Come on. What I just added was a predicate that looks like this. So you simply use Boolean operators, and or, literally. So if you want to match two predicates, you still do it between one pair of square brackets and just say what the first predicate is, and then say, and it must match the second predicate. And if I wanted to be even more particular or more clear, I could say, for our document, child colon colon rating equals quote unquote R. Okay, John, you had a question? Okay. Sure. True. It's an excellent question. Why, when designing the document in the first place, might you want to make rating an attribute versus making it a child element? I would say it depends, is the short answer. Part of it is simply arbitrary. But the reason that you might typically want to use a child element is if there's any chance of further extensibility of that element. A rating, it's hard to imagine a rating getting even more refined than just a value PG or R. And yet, arguably, you could say, well, maybe a rating should in the future be associated with the person who actually assigned that rating. And we might want to associate yet more metadata with the rating and say it was Joe Bob who assigned this movie a rating of R. In which case, it would not be far-sighted for us to use an attribute for a rating because attributes are not extensible. So the short answer is it depends. I would say, too, that files like this, even though a lot of these fields really aren't extensible in concept, the file starts to get messy very quickly when you start having long strings of attributes. It just gets harder for a human being, for instance, to parse visually or to read or to maintain. So that, too, in and of itself might be a reason to make them child elements. The short answer is, it depends. Is it easier from a parsing standpoint? No, I would say arguably it would take more processing to parse the child elements, but it depends on what size documents you're talking about, whether that's relevant or not. So we've only scratched the surface. Let's take our 5-minute break. There's cookies here, and we'll come back in at 40 after. We are back. And clearly cookies are more popular than the candy, huh? Because I've been going home with like 2 dozen lollipops the past 3 weeks. So maybe we'll go with cookies for now on or the like. Okay, so I said a moment ago that we've just begun scratching the surface because you can really start to do some neat things. In fact, we've only looked at just a couple of the axes. And so what you see here is a list of all of the possible axes that you can make use of in a location path. And just to be clear where we're going with this, XPath in and of itself It's just a query language that XSLT will see shortly uses in order to allow you means of grabbing data from an XML file. So for now, we're looking at it in a bit of a vacuum. Think of this as us tinkering with MySQL and typing SQL commands at the prompt. Not so useful running them at the prompt, but we're going to embed them into a framework in just a moment. Notice that we have axes that are pretty self-explanatory. In fairness, we had the attribute axis, which says, with respect to the current node or the current node set, only consider the attributes of each of those nodes. So attribute colon colon would do that. We had the child axis, of course, which means consider all the children of this node. We have a whole bunch of others, which, again, sort of self-explanatory. If you said ancestor colon colon, perhaps at this point, it would be a little weird, but suppose that we said, go dive into movies, go dive into, let's say, movie, and from here, let's say, only choose those movies that have a rating of R, and you can use single or double quotes so long as you haven't used that same system outside of your query. From here, go to titles. But then suppose you decide, and this is not to be recommended, but it illustrates how the axis would affect behavior. You could from here say, you know what, actually, let's go ahead and print out not just the title elements, but let's go from these title elements that we've selected and go back and choose all of the movies elements and then do something else. Now, I say this is not to be recommended because you're doing unnecessary processing, but consider what that denotes. You start here, or you dive down deeper. You choose only those movie elements whose rating is R. You then choose their title. Then you say, wait a minute, let's go back and get the movies elements that are ancestors of these title elements. Well, what are you going to select from your document? How many nodes? Just one, because there's only one movies element in the first place. Suppose I took off this trailing S. How many movie elements are you going to choose? All of them? Right. Only the ones that are, in fact, ancestors of these title elements, which I believe in our demo was 4, came back with a rating of R. So realize that it's the ancestors called movie of the nodes in your current node set. And that refers then only to those 4 or so movie elements that we picked earlier. So the filters still apply because we're taking the ancestors of those nodes, not all title elements in general. We'll see, though, as time passes, more relevant uses because this is silly. You should be writing your predicates in a more intelligent way. But we have other things like ancestor or self, which means not only consider your ancestors but also include yourself under when performing a node test. Descendant or self. Following, we'll highlight that in just a moment, and following sibling. Namespace, which we will punt on for a couple of weeks' time till we come back to the issues of namespaces. But for now, namespaces themselves, which we said last week or 2 weeks ago very briefly, that it's sort of the notion of imposing scope on certain constructs, elements, and so forth. In fact, we're seeing namespaces already tonight, though we're not going to dwell on it. Any of these elements prefixed with XSL colon, these are elements with some name, but the namespace to which they belong is the XSL namespace, and that in turn is associated with a longer string of characters, a URL-like entity. Preceding, preceding, sibling, and self itself, well, let's consider these graphically because it makes them a bit more clear. If we consider that blue node, what you have here in effect is a DOM view of an XML document. For our purposes, doesn't matter what's an element, what's a text node, all of these things are nodes for our purposes right now. Suppose that the context node, the only node in our current node set, as I told our tale earlier, is that blue node. And you choose the following. Suppose that node is called $node. Just we'll call, use that as a placeholder, a variable, if you will. And I go ahead and choose following sibling. And here, too, is a sort of wildcard notion. If you don't care about the name of the sibling, but rather want to match any, you can use star. And star would say any node. In fact, the node test then is match any named element so long as it is a sibling of the current element. So if our current node is the blue guy and we say proceed from here to take a step along the following sibling axis, choosing any element, no matter its name, which nodes and how many is it going to choose for us? With respect to this picture? Two. Right? The two guys to the right. Moreover, what you're going to get back is a node set, and I called it a linked list earlier, which is pretty reasonable because there is order imposed. When you exercise XPath queries, the nodes are returned to you not only in this notion called a node set, which for all intents and purposes are a linked list or a vector, but you get them back in what's called document order. And a document is specified in this case as having an order of 1 and then 2. So you will get back the closest sibling, followed by, at index location 2, the second sibling. And so we number them as follows. If we instead consider the same blue node and choose the descendant axis, we'll start with this node, dollar sign node, and now choose not following sibling, but choose descendant, matching any node test. Well, how many nodes are we going to get back here? Six? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. A descendant, like in a family tree, is everyone that comes after you that you can reach via some path. And the node, the document order in which they are returned is an effect, for our purposes here, it's like a depth first search, starting from the node in question. So that's the order in which you get it. In spirit, it's sort of a top-down, left-right approach, if you will. Okay, and that's the order. And that's often important because if you then proceed to iterate over this node set, it's often useful to actually have some expectations as to the order in which these nodes are going to be processed. Or at least the nice thing about XPath is that you can trust that they will be returned in document order and not in the like attributes returned in some order. So this is not hold for attributes if you follow the attribute axis. No order is guaranteed, recall. But you will get them, the children and descendants and so forth, back in document order. What about ancestor? How many nodes are going to be selected? Okay, two. So, and they're going to go, in this case, they're going to count from the closest on upward, just as with siblings. So we have one followed by two. We have a little blank slate here. If we were to choose, for instance, let's try a crazy one, preceding. Suppose that the same node, I can't highlight it, but suppose that it's that same node on the second level, second from the left, is our blue node, and I said preceding. Well, the question then is, if you start from that node and take a step along the preceding axis, choosing star, you know, any node called anything, or any element called anything, what do you think you'd get back? One to the left. Oh, I hear left and then down. So what preceding means conceptually is all of the elements that were opened and closed before this element in the document. And by opened and closed, I mean you witnessed their start tag and their end tag before we got to this node in the document. So whose open and start tags have we already witnessed by the time during a depth first search of our tree we reach that node? The three to the left. What about the ancestor of this guy, the root? Isn't he before? Isn't he preceding this one? It hasn't been closed yet, right? This element is inside of him, so he certainly hasn't that ancestor certainly hasn't preceded him in the document. It's, in fact, an ancestor. Yeah.
Well, what about the three on the very left?
So these three is the answer.
What about the two?
I'm sorry?
Right
to the two to its left. So
you said with the block down here.
These three.
Right. You said the one that was highlighted was the second one, no, that one.
Oh no, this is the one I meant. Just as with the previous Oh, I'm sorry. No, this was the one I meant. Sorry.
Okay.
That's the node I was talking about. So in that case, it's all of the nodes that were open before and closed before we actually witnessed this guy's start element. Sorry, I forgot that we moved the blue dot around. So I leave this as a blank slate if you'd like to play around at home. But this, too, is something where something like Stylus or even we'll see Zeilen, it's just useful to play around with And Michael Kay's book, again, is you don't need to buy any books for this course to do well, but Michael Kay's book is that red, thick book if you've seen it on the shelf anywhere. I would order these things online rather than trying to get them at the Coop because you'll overpay. But you will find it a wonderful reference and perhaps more exhaustive, certainly more self-contained than a lot of the resources on the web. It is the only XML book that I tend to pull off the shelf since, I mean, the rest of XML, you know, as I've said, open tag, close tag. So for XSLT and XPath, it's useful. So what do we mean by node tests? We've already said a node test can just be a node's name, and that's perhaps the most common or most obvious, straightforward use of it. A node test can actually also be a namespace qualifier, colon, then the name of a node, but we won't dwell so much on that for now. We'll come back to that. You can say namespace colon star, which means for certain namespace, the foo namespace, any node therein, or any element name therein, or what we'll see for tonight and for much of our work, just star, which means choose any element for most contexts. You can say node, which is sort of a node test function, which means don't check the name, but just check the type. So get back pretty much any node in question. It's sort of, we'll see in time that there's a distinction between saying star and saying node. Star, to be exact, will only match those nodes of the quote-unquote principal node type on your current access. And I think it's best that I not elaborate on that for now, but we'll see that there's a distinction between star and node and what each of them matches. Node, open paren, close paren, is the more inclusive one. Star actually won't return all nodes, but only certain nodes in certain contexts, but we'll get to that. Comment, of course, means if you've got a whole bunch of nodes in your collection and you only want to match those that are of type comment, well, you filter out by way of comment, text, similarly, processing instruction, and so forth. Abbreviated syntax. XPath would be a nasty little language if you always had to write child colon colon, an attribute colon colon. You've already seen some of the shorthands. For instance, if you want to specify the child access, don't specify any access at all. Just use the empty string, quote, unquote. You don't need to put anything there. It's assumed. If you don't specify an access, child is assumed. If you don't want to write attribute colon colon, just write at, the at symbol. And that will be implied, the attribute access. If you want to say descendant or self, colon, colon, node, you choose slash, slash. Now, what the heck does that mean? Well, this is perhaps the lazy man's access. It is hard to imagine appropriate uses for this query because it pretty much induces an exhaustive search of your XML document, which tends not to be wise. Could be applicable, but for the purposes of demonstration, it's often quite quick. What I mean by that is the following. If you want to retrieve from this document all of the title elements, well, we could start at the root, and we could say database, and then we could say movies, right, just as we did before. But we have these axes now. We don't just have the child access. We have the descendant access. So couldn't I be a little bit lazy and say, you know, start at the root, but then just say go through all of the descendants and then just find me the title elements? Okay, you could, but what's the problem with this? It's going to search the whole document. And which branch of this tree, if you will, do you clearly not need to search exhaustively for title elements? Actors. But what are you going to do with this query? Well, actors is a descendant of the root. So is every actor element. So is every child node, text node of those actor elements. You're really wasting cycles unnecessarily. But certainly when you want to design some code or tinker around, perfectly reasonable to say, you know, give me all the titles. Slash, slash, title. And what does it do? Essentially an exhaustive search of the entire tree, and it returns to you the nodes that match. But what I have just said with slash slash is slash descendant or self colon colon node, rather not colon colon node, colon colon title, enter. And that returns to me all of the title elements no matter where they are in the document. So again, useful for tinkering. Very bad practice to put in code because what's lazy and saves you, you know, a few mental cycles initially, as your documents grow, not so wise when you start parsing the whole document unnecessarily. Self colon colon node, this exists really for reflexivity, but you can say dot, And it's quite useful when you want to test the value of some current node, as we'll see in some demos. Parent colon colon node would properly get you back to the parent element, but dot dot suffices as well. But there too, it's hard to imagine proper uses of this in most contexts, because if you're saying dot dot, it often means, at least for someone learning XPath and XSLT, that you didn't do some kind of predicate early enough. You probably made some mistake, but it is often helpful within predicates themselves, as we'll see. So data types, just to get these out of the way. Just as in DOM, where you have these data types, so do you have the notion of data types in XPath. They pretty much steal the same data types from DOM. And the fact of the matter is that you don't really need to worry, for most uses of XPath, about the various data types. And you don't have to worry so much about strong typing and so forth, because it really is a query language, and there's a lot of automatic conversion that occurs among these types, which is to say you can do, for instance, in XPath, things like checking some value. And if the value is 1, well, that's equivalent to the Boolean value true. Java does not allow that sort of automatic conversion. You can't say while 1 in Java. You have to say while true, or while 1 equals 1, or something like that. So I put them up there for thoroughness, but not something I think that is interesting to dwell on. But just to rattle off some of the functions and some of the operators that you can use in XPath, not so much because they are interesting to talk about, but so that you've seen them at least once and have a reference for going back to. Anytime you have some kind of Boolean value, you can deploy operators like these. You can AND things together, OR things together. We saw that earlier on the board when I, on the screen when I did that demonstration of a double predicate by ANDing them together. Well, predicate is sort of naturally a Boolean concept. When you say equals X equals Y, well, the answer is going to be yes or no, true or false. So we've seen these types already. Those are the operators that might relate. A lot of this is going to be intuitive, and you would sort of expect that a lot of these operators exist based on your savvy with other languages. If you've got a type that's a number, like the number 1, 2, 3, you can use such functions as these. And I say dot, dot, dot because there are more. And one of the best references for these kinds of things is the W3 Schools link on the course's resources page. Just go under XPath and look for the W3 Schools XPath tutorial or reference or whatever it's called. They have a nice little table in HTML of these various functions. If you've got a string in question, this is a string, quote, unquote, R. If you wanted to concatenate strings together or check if a string contains some substring, or starts with some character, we saw that, or has a certain length, or has a certain substring after, or translate, allows you some limited sort of regular expression type capabilities, well, these kinds of functions exist as well. Again, not fun, I think, to dwell on, because most of the behavior should be familiar to you from other domains, but just know from glancing at them that they exist, and again, turning to something like the online references is the way to figure out how you do something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Does it really slow down the processing? Well, first of all, it's worth noting. It depends on the implementation as to when these XPath expressions are evaluated. But typically, there is so much other parsing going on of the XML document that I would not worry so much about your string matching at the XPath level. Because already has every other character in the XML document been looked at during the parsing process. So worst case, you're talking about a linear cost if you're simply pattern matching again on some of that content, assuming you're not doing it multiple passes. So I wouldn't worry about that as a concern. There are much more egregious design decisions that we'll encounter. And it really comes to designing the templates and how you select the nodes, not how you pattern match on them. If you have a node set itself returned, well, you can figure out how many nodes have been returned. You can get the current node, which we'll see in an iterative context. There's a for each construct we'll come to in just a moment. You can get the last node in a node set. You can check its name, where you are in a node set, because, again, there is some document order. And, again, to be clear, I'm going fast because these are more interesting to see in context, not to see enumerated on slides. Converting types, this slide essentially says what you would expect in most languages. If you've got a 1, it converts automatically in the right context to a true. If you've got a 0, it converts automatically to the notion of false. These are the sort of conventions that you would expect. They exist, too, in XPath. So, yeah.
How much
So what if you write the cosine? You want to use the cosine function, which is not built into XPath by default, because you want to compute some geometric or trigonometric values. Your XPath processor would throw an error, and by that I typically mean your XSLT processor, if that's the context in which you're doing it. The result would be in Xalin, you would get an error printed to standard error, and it would print on the screen. Using Stylus, you would get a little alert in the window in the bottom. In XML Spy, you'd get a little alert in the bottom saying error at line such and such. So it's not exceptions necessarily, it's error messages, if you will, at the command line. Okay, so XSLT, we've spent so much time talking about what you can do with it. I'm going to gloss over some of these details. The history is pretty much consistent with where XPath came from. So here we go. Let's dive right into it. This is an example of XHTML 1.0 as generated by XSLT. In fact, we now begin to get our hands dirty with some actual XSLT. XSLT is, again, a language for transforming XML into something else. So what do we mean by that? Well, consider this framework, and I'm going to open it up in Stylus so that we can actually start navigating it. I'm going to open the file called, let's see, in examples, myblockbuster.xml/myfirstxsl. Notice that Stylus is also an XSLT editor, which means it understands XSLT, and that too is useful because it will give you little hints as to what functions or templates you can use. This is the exact same file as we just saw a moment ago. Notice that, yes, it's XHTML, but there's clearly some other stuff in here. What I'm going to do first, and this is slightly different in Stylus and with Xalin, but you'll see in Stylus that I want to associate this XSLT style sheet with an XML document, because the whole idea of XSLT essentially boils down to the world of XSLT involves application of a style sheet to an XML file to generate some output. So to make that association in Stylus, you click this little ellipsis at top. You then specify the source XML, which for our purposes is going to be myblockbuster.xml, which comes with Project 2. The output URL I'm going to leave alone, but I'm going to say preview result in external application. So that is simply going to pop up IE to display the HTML output or the XHTML output to me. Okay, here is our style sheet. Notice that our XML file is just behind the scenes over here. So what I'm going to begin to do now is to use what we've learned about XPath in the context of this style sheet. Notice first, though, if I just play this style sheet, so Stylus's way of saying apply XSLT to the XML is to hit the play button. So I hit play, IE pops up. What do you say? It's pretty dull, right? Even I can generate this kind of web page. But look, the title, at least, is interesting, right? That's an interesting title, My First XSLT-Generated Web Page. Well, let's actually generate some content here. Well, how can we go about doing that? Well, what would you like us to do? This is a style sheet that's going to be applied to myblockbuster.xml, whose contents you're familiar with now. What would you like the body of this web page to contain? What's that? That XML. Well, that's kind of boring, right? We don't need all this setup. We don't need a two-hour lecture to just display the XML.
I want to list the movies.
Oh, you want to list the movies. Quite reasonable. So let's start with just the titles. How can we do this? Well, in XSLT, yes, you can use XPath, and you'll often use XPath to select the nodes that you want to do something with. But XSLT's instructions, or elements as they're called, allow you get further power, further features, really logical control over that content. The first construct, then, that we'll introduce is called XSL for each. You can guess what this is going to do. Many of these XSL elements are take an attribute of select, or select by convention means select what nodes to iterate over in this case. And here's the nice thing about Stylus, and again, it's a wonderful learning tool. Because of this, anything you get in like Visual Studio or Eclipse, You get it here too. Moreover, you get the types of data you can choose. Because we've associated this XSLT file with the XML file, Stylus also tells us what data we can select as well as what functions are applicable. So in that regard, it's almost better than like Visual Studio or Eclipse because it knows about the data to which you're about to apply the file. So we're going to start with database. We are going to then dive into the movies. And what am I writing here? What's this an example of? True, but generally speaking, this is XPath. Here's where XPath goes, as the value of some of these expressions. Now I want movie. Now I want the title, right? So it doesn't really get easier than this, especially when you're being prompted every step of the way. So I'm going to close it. That's the only attribute I'm going to apply. Nice thing about Stylus, too, XML Spy does the same thing. Notepad does not. Hit slash and it realizes, oh, I'm going to close the most recently opened element. Saves you a few keystrokes here and there. All right, I'm indenting to keep things pretty, but by no means prerequisite because this is XML after all. It's just for our purposes. So here we are in this loop. On every iteration, the so-called context node is going to become one of the nodes in document order from the document. How do I get at the current one? Well, I can get at the value of the current node, which is going to be the concatenation of all of his descendants, by doing value of, select, and what can I select here? Well, what do we want to select? Okay, true, that would just print out one, or not even, that would print out one. We want to print out the value, but of what? Of the context node. How do we get at myself? Dot. Right? Because what we're iterating over is not the movie elements, but the title elements, so we iterate over dot. I saved it. I'm going to hit play. IE pops up. Beautiful. Sort of. What do we need to add? This is HTML or XHTML. All right, so let's maybe, let's get crazy here. So I like my unordered lists. I want a bulleted list. So I'm going to, in the proper space, keep everything well-formed, indent just to keep things visually clean. I've got an unordered list. Where do I want to put my LI items? Maybe right here. LI there. Oops. LI there. Play. There we go. Getting there. Pretty. I like alphabetization. How do we fix that? How do we sort? Well, and this one's a little strange because it's useful, but it doesn't really fit the same conceptual model. There's actually an XSL sort element. And I say it's a little strange because there are only certain places where this is allowed. And if it appears in this context, it must be the first child of the for each. You can't just put it anywhere. It's got to be the first child of the for each. So it's called sort. Well, what do you want to sort on? We want to sort on the current node. And there are some other attributes in there that I glossed over, but you can specify if you want it to be ascending or descending. You can specify the type. Should it be treated as strings, as numbers? So sometimes data types are actually relevant for sorting, certainly. All right, play. There we go. And now it's sorted. So now we're getting somewhere, right? An ugly web page, to be sure, but dynamically generated. And we can change the formatting of this. And we didn't have to write all that much code to generate a very scalable web page. You plug in more data, more titles will show up. Let's change our approach. Suppose that this is a little weird to be using dot all of the time, perhaps, and maybe I didn't think to go that far down in the tree, so I said movie. Well, now if I hit play, well, now we have that sort of messy problem. Because what is the value of a movie element? Yeah, I saw this, right? The concatenation of all of its textual descendants, which is everything. Well, that's messy. How do I fix this so that we're only displaying the titles again? What's that? We don't need to loop again, though, because we just want the title, and there's only one, presumably. Sorry? Okay, yeah. So if we want to be really particular, we say child, :, title. But you know you don't have to do that. Just say title. And down here, title. So notice what's happening. When we have a for each, at this point in the processing, we have a node set back. And the nodes in that set are of what type? Movie, in this case. When you have a subsequent XPath query, it is evaluated with respect to the current context node or context nodes, which means if in my bucket of nodes, my node set are movie elements, singular, well, then the next step I would take from those nodes would obviously be title. It would not be correct, for instance, to say slash title, right? That implies go all the way back to the root of the document, find a title element. No, there are no title elements at the root. There's a database element only. But if we fix this, hit play, out pops IE, and now the problem has come back. Or the problem has gone away. Sorry, John.
So if you wanted those to print out 20-point
red, okay.
Would you do a CSS to this, or do you do the CSS to the document before you process it with?
Excellent question. So where now we want to take things the final step. We want to bring things home and actually affect the aesthetics. Well, we could certainly just put in here, you know, our font tag and specify a face and a relative size, but that's messy. If we wanted to use CSS and actually apply that, we would just include the CSS in this file as you might in any other context. So we might say, for instance here, a span tag whose style attribute, and stylists also understand XHTML, which is nice, style equals color red, and then font size equals 20 points. Let's add the span over here. Process. And there you go. And similarly, could you just at the top of this file.
That's not CSS.
This is, yes. It's the inline CSS. I could, though, have embedded at the top, I could have used a, style tag and specified with its href value a foo.css file in which were our definitions. And then here, I wouldn't use the style attribute. I would say something like class equals my style. And my style would be defined in that CSS file. So in short, you do CSS exactly the same way as you might usually in this file. The only distinction is what an XSLT processor does is any element prefixed with XSL colon, it treats in a special manner. It applies some inherent knowledge about it and processes it. Anything that it doesn't recognize as being XSLT, i.e. anything that doesn't have this namespace prefix, is passed through raw, which means if you have a style element for CSS inclusion, it gets passed through raw, so it's going to end up in the output document. If you have a span tag and that is not in the XSL namespace, it's going to get passed through raw, so you're going to get XHTML with CSS. So in short, you use CSS no differently. You just include it in your style sheet as you normally would in an HTML file. What about the filtration again? Let's just for thoroughness sake go back to this notion of filtering out those movies so that we only display the R-rated movies. What do I do? Quickest solution. Put it in the select here. Okay. Okay, square bracket, rating equals, perfect. Play. Good, much shorter list. What else could we do? Well, just to introduce some other constructs, and we'll do this over this week and next, as well as just in the online references, you'll see yet more you can do. What if we simply did this? What if we did XSL if, there's an if construct, whose attribute is test, and in test should go a Boolean expression or something that evaluates to a Boolean. Well, what do I want to do? I want to say, you know what? Test if the current rating equals R, or rather the current movie's rating child equals R, and if so, then do that, otherwise don't. Hit play. There is no equals equals in XSLT or in XPath. It's just single equal. So that too worked. There's the notion of a choose, which we'll come back to in a more interesting demo, where we could say this actually. Let's be a little crazy here. So XSL, let's get rid of the if. And again, this is sort of XSLT by demonstration. We have XSL choose, which doesn't take any attributes. I'm just going to fast forward and put the end tag so we don't forget. XSL when This is a weird construct. It's like a switch, but we use choose and when and else, and it's sort of a weird amalgam. But when test, so when rating equals R, let's go ahead and do this, but this, let's see, title, good, my style doesn't exist. I'm going to go back to using a bit of CSS just to say color equals red. Okay, span. Okay, now I have to close my when. XSL when test rating equals, let's say, G. Then I'm going to print out the same thing, a bullet, but we're going to choose a green color to denote that it's, you know, safe. Else, oh, even I forget. It's XSL otherwise. Right, right. Terseness in XML markup is clearly of minimal importance. Here we're going to put another one of these, and we'll just say that the color will be black. Whew. Play. There we go. So all of our R-rated movies are red, all of our green movie, all of our G movies are green, and all of our PG or PG-13 movies or NC-17 movies are in black. In this case. So again, not a pretty web page. Tonight's focus is on the logic, but again, here, we're just introducing, by example, dare say, some of these programmatic concepts. And I did not pick the naming scheme, and even I forget what's else, what's if, what's choose, what's other, I mean, God, otherwise, I don't know what they were thinking. But such is the design decision. Couple more examples, couple more pieces of jargon. And then we will let you at it over the next few days. So we have here just a quick list of the types of nodes that exist in XSLT. This, too, is something you need not dwell on. Understanding DOM is sort of sufficient to understanding any tree-based view of the XML world. But it just so happens that both XPath and XSLT impose their own tree-based hierarchical view of an XML document. The reason being, all of these APIs are designed to be independent of one another, or rather, they were designed independent of one another. So this is to say, XSLT and XPath, even though they navigate a document as though it were a tree, good implementations probably do not use DOM. DOM is not an efficient implementation, does not offer efficient navigation of XML documents. What you will find is that Xalin, for instance, uses its own rather clever, rather nasty implementation of a tree by using, in effect, a lot of arrays, at least as of the last time I looked at the source code. It doesn't use a DOM in the proper sense, because recall, after all, with a DOM, how do you access all of the children of a node? Well, you don't have direct links, you know, n links to the children. You have this, in effect. You have a pointer to one of the children or to the linked list, and then you can iterate over the children. That does not lend itself to efficient processing. It doesn't lend itself to efficient hash lookups of values and so forth. So you'll find that conceptually we introduced DOM because, one, it is a valid API to use, and it is possible to use. But even though it could underlie some of these higher-level APIs, probably doesn't. But they all sort of borrow the same ideas. So in XSLT, you similarly speak of an XML document having comment nodes, root nodes, element nodes, but these are not necessarily the same as their equivalent in DOM. But they pretty much are. Conceptually, they are. Programmatically, they are distinct. Here are some of the most common XSLT elements, certainly a quick list of those that we've introduced already tonight. XSLT style sheet, rather, XSL style sheet. It must appear as the very top of your document, and if you look over the demonstration from tonight, there are some pretty standard things. For now, it's a copy-paste job that you would include. You specify the version of XSLT in use. You specify the namespace for XSLT. For now, it's a copy-paste. We'll elaborate on that in the future. There's an output element, which governs what kind of output you're generating. And this is a useful element. It must appear as the child of that root element we discussed a second ago. And it lets you specify if you're outputting text or HTML or XHTML or really XML. And it all has to do with how the XSLT processor will format the output. Because notice here I've said indent equals yes. That means that there will be a lot of ignorable white space inferred from the document, but things will be pretty printed in the end because we've told the processor, pretty print this, or rather indent this. Yes. So that exists. Then there's, of course, for each. and value of. Pretty straightforward. We've seen those. We've seen already XSL otherwise. If and when and choose. So already you have quite the repertoire. There's many others. And then the most important, dare say, are the ones under bullet 2. Apply templates, call template, template, and with param. Which of those have we seen in use already? Which one? Call template we did see on the screen, but only in the context of my own shared.xsl file for the course website. What did this use? So our demo from a moment ago uses template match equals quote unquote slash. This is the approach we'll take for now with a lot of our demonstrations because it essentially allows you to jumpstart the process of applying a style sheet to a document starting at its root. So suffice it to say for now that this, for tonight's purposes, starting up here, is effectively the equivalent in XSLT of a main function or a main method in Java. That's where you jumpstart the process. You don't need to start this way. There are other, perhaps more clever ways of starting, but I think conceptually and as you learn, it's easiest to jumpstart the process by just matching the root and working on down as we did, pulling what data out of the document that you want. But generally speaking, templates, as they're called, are a near equivalent of methods or of functions that you might be used to, and they are called based on what they match. So if you match the root of an XML document, as we did, that's going to be the first one that gets called because you can't match deeper in the document until you've matched the root. So for now, assume that that's how you begin the process. If, however, we had a template that matched foo and we used call templates, in effect, what the XSLT processor would do would look over all of its nodes, and any time it saw an element called foo, guess what template it would call and apply it to that element? The one that matches foo. But we'll see more demonstrations of this sort of thing. Yep? There wouldn't be a, what do you mean, a processing instruction before foo? No. Notice that there's only a node test in the match here. We don't have an absolute path. In this case, you could have an absolute path, but because we don't, this foo element could appear anywhere in the document. So the answer to your question as to what foo elements might this be applied, in effect, depends on how this template was called. And that, again, we'll see in the future. Name templates. Just as you can match, we'll see next week, too, that you can have templates called by name, where you don't say, call the templates that are appropriate to these nodes. Rather, you say, call this template. Very much in the C, C++, Java concept of calling a function or a method. You can pass in parameters. If at the top you have a template defined and you want it to take some inputs, use XSL param. You give the parameter a name so that you have a sort of key value lookup ability. And then you can have a default value. Here, the default value of that template, for tonight's purposes, would be baz, but it can be overridden if you call that template with a param by that same name with its own value. But again, we'll see these in use next week. Applying templates is the means by which the process is jump-started, and the reason that the default value of an element is the concatenation of all of its textual descendants in XSLT, as you've seen tonight when we got those massive blobs of data coming out of the document. It's for this reason. This is a lot to absorb, and so we'll come back to this next week. But notice, first of all, that this template up here, as I've dubbed it, is a built-in template. That means even if you don't write it, you get it for free. It's like an implicit constructor. Even though you don't write a constructor, it still exists because in Java, an object will in fact be instantiated even if you don't give it a constructor. Or in C++. If this is the built-in template, notice what it's implying. This means even if you don't implement any template that matches the root element or a foo element or any element in the document for that matter, notice that this template is designed to match any element, star, and then the vertical bar here is the union operator, so it effectively means match any element or the root. Well, if you match on any element or the root, what should you do? What this next statement says, well, you just apply templates to all of the children of the nodes you've just matched. Okay. What if eventually you match not on an element, that is star, but on a text node or an attribute? What should you do? Well, there are no children for a text node. There are no children for an attribute. So what you should do by default is print the value of. So if mentally you make this leap for tonight's purposes of thinking, all right, if for every element the result is to apply whatever templates exist for all of its children, well, your base case in this mental recursion is going to be eventually you're going to hit attributes and text nodes in the document whose values will be printed. So recursively, what you have, even if you don't specify any templates in your file, as we can now do, is a recursive process that ultimately, notice, there are no templates now. We only have the built-in templates. If I apply this, notice what happens. This is stylus being stupid and not showing it on another screen. Notice what we have. We have all of the textual content from the file. All XML is gone, but all of the text children have been displayed as present. This is the equivalent in stylus to what IE was doing earlier when we were simply not defining with CSS behavior for some of those elements. The default behavior was just to spit it out. And this is a lot to absorb when you've just sort of started to see this context. Oh, and notice, incidentally, you'll notice that if you have comments in an XML file, you process that XML file with an XSLT style sheet, what happens to those comments according to this template? Gone. Why? It's an empty element, which in effect is saying match on a comment node and then do nothing. Don't even print its value. Value, recursive descent. So let's introduce this final slide. How do you process XSLT? Project 2 will walk you through the process of using Xalin, which for our purposes initially will be a command line operation, but later with projects 3 and 4, it is Xalin that we will use through Java code. So take comfort in the fact that XSLT does not require that you type esoteric commands at a prompt, but that's where we'll begin. To process XSLT, you can also, of course, use MSXML, which comes for free when you install Windows or upgrade IE. And how do you make use of it for XSLT? Well, one way is to actually include a PI, like we saw earlier tonight. If you use Saxon, Saxon is a download similar to Xalin and Xerxes that you could similarly write code against that would apply a style sheet to an XML document. Stylus Studio you've seen in action, and applying a style sheet to an XML document is as simple as clicking play. XML Spy is effectively the equivalent. By all means, use the listserv to ask questions of me and others about how to use those programs. But if you take comfort in knowing that you only need to use 1% of those programs, you don't need to understand most of the menu options and so forth because they do much more these days than just XML and XSLT. So Project 2, on a final note, has essentially three components, each of which is of increasing interest, if not complexity, the first of which asks you to, and we've made mention of these final slides here, what Trax is and CSS versus XSLT. Project 2 has three components, the first of which asks you to very simply convert a date time string in a prescribed format to its XML counterpart. This is really an exercise in some of those XPath functions like the substring function or the TR function perhaps, or you'll see if you look on an online reference for XPath functions on our own slides tonight, you're going to want to tease apart what the hour field is from the string, what the minutes are, and then you're going to want to format those as XML. It's really just an exercise in acquainting you with some of the basics of XPath. My blockbuster is much more interesting, much more fun. Given myblockbuster.xml, you are challenged with actually displaying that information in a navigable framework using hyperlinks that jump you back and forth between content, format things more prettily than we did here tonight, and XTube is the end game of the project where you'll make use of these nice maps and a huge database on the order of a few hundred K and do some really nice work with both XSLT and XHTML and also SVG. So as of tonight, you should be sufficiently prepared to take on both, to be honest. It's B2B time and even my blockbuster, though with next week's lecture, you'll get more background that will help with at least my blockbuster and then X2. But feel free to venture on your own. So we'll do a casual section tonight in room 106 where we'll do a bit of Q&A, walkthrough. Otherwise, I will see you next week.